Okay, so I broke my message into two parts today, partly because I thought if I talked that long, you might leave, and partly because this is what made the most sense to me. Have you ever looked closely at a labyrinth? I have one to show you. Theo's on it. There we go. Do any of you recognize this? Yeah. This is the labyrinth right down the road from us here in Belfast. One thing I notice about labyrinths that I've always found interesting is that most often when you follow the path in, it takes you closer to the center right away. And then as you walk, you move further away from the center to the edges, furthest from your goal, before again taking another turn and going into the heart. It always struck me as a great metaphor for going through hard times, when we're walking the labyrinth of life, when we keep going, even when it seems like we're the furthest away from that which we seek. When we deny the temptation to turn back and instead trust in that power of moving through the hardest times, that to me feels like resilience, a trust and a determination that will bring us home to center. There's something in the journey that if we let it, it will change us. I once had a client, I'm calling her Lori. She was in her 30s, a type A personality, who, like most type A's, worked really hard, loved control, and had her self-worth all tied up in achievement and meeting the arbitrary markers that society and family and her own overachieving mind had created for her. Can anyone relate? In our initial appointment, she shared with me very lightly, calmly, and with great intellectual prowess, that she just wanted therapy to help her meet her goals so that she could make important decisions in life. She felt like she was behind her peers because she wasn't married yet, didn't have a child, and her career wasn't exactly where she wanted it to be. So she'd just gone through a difficult breakup, but she was fine. Would she put herself back out on the dating scene? Would she freeze her eggs? Surely she could handle it. Would she move to a bigger city for more career opportunities? She just wanted a no-nonsense approach to making a plan that would have her feeling productive and on track again. She got me instead. What happened next was pretty intense, an emotional crisis, a breakdown, if you will. Through our time together, the more we worked, the more clear it became that Lori was stuck in those thought loops that wouldn't let her out, a prison of her mind's making, where each possible decision led to a fear that she was missing something and making the wrong decision, which led to a different decision, which led to the same fear, which took us back to the first decision, and so on and so on. The problem, of course, wasn't the decision. The problem, of course, was Lori's fear of getting it wrong, and her need to believe that she had the ability to make the perfect decision in the first place. The need to be in control of her life's outcomes. The problem was the need for that certainty and the underneath it all belief that if only she were good enough, she could figure it all out. Doubt not included. Now, you can imagine that as we went deeper and deeper into this struggle, it became more and more scary for Lori. And her symptoms grew in number and intensity. It was absolutely true that for a while, Lori was much worse off than when she first came to me. From the outside, it might have seemed as though I was the world's worst therapist, and therapy itself was failing. But that wasn't what was happening. And thank all that is good and holy that Lori didn't give up, and that neither did I. My favorite quote about labyrinths is from Simone Weil. I've shared it with you before. Simone Weil is a French philosopher, a mystic, a political activist, and this quote is taken from her book, Waiting for God. She said, "The beauty of the world is the mouth of a labyrinth. The unwary individual who, on entering, takes a few steps and is soon unable to find the opening again. Worn out, with nothing to eat or drink, in the dark, separated from dear ones and from everything they love and are accustomed to, they walk on without knowing anything or hoping anything, incapable even of discovering whether they're really going forward or merely turning round on the same spot. Now that is where we've all found ourselves, I'm sure, at one moment or another in our lives. And that was exactly where Lori was for a time. But Simone goes on to say, but this affliction is as nothing compared with the danger that's threatening them. For if they do not lose courage, if they go on walking, it is absolutely certain that they will arrive at the center of the labyrinth. A good thing. And there God is waiting. Do you know what comes next? To eat them. Later, they will go out again, but they will be changed. They will have become different after being eaten and digested by God. Afterward, they will stay near the entrance so that they can gently push all those who come near into the opening. That's a much more poetic way of saying what Eric Greitens was saying about you can't bounce back, you can only move through and let the bad stuff change you, because anything else is avoidance and regression. But I think the most revealing part of that quote is that after being eaten and digested or being kicked around by life, however you want to think about it, after all of that, after all of the hardship and fear and struggle, when you're done, when you're on the other side, you want everyone else to experience it too. That's a pretty powerful statement about how good getting through the hard stuff can be and how worth it it is. Throughout my time with Lori, I had to keep reminding her that the breakdown of sorts that she was going through wasn't just more wasted time. That even though she felt further from her goals than ever, she was actually the closest she'd ever been to reaching them. And that was true. And I was grateful for the people who had pushed me into the mouth of the labyrinth when I needed it, so that I could see and know that pushing her in was right too. Part two. Because it isn't just individuals that go into the labyrinth or that need the pushing or that have to cultivate resilience. It's also our institutions, our organizations, our country. I wanted to tell you a little bit of a story about the UUA, our Unitarian Universalist denomination. In early March of 2017, our own denomination faced a labyrinth moment. I was in seminary and looking forward to attending my first General Assembly in New Orleans that June. And I was so excited to know that I would be doing my ministerial internship beginning in August, here, of all places, with Reverend Dean Perkins. Up until that point, I had a very rosy picture of Unitarian Universalism. I really thought it was perfect, and I couldn't understand why everyone wasn't a UU. I was very proud of who we are and very centered in my faith and my understanding of what that meant. So it was rather devastating when it all blew up. Here's the story in brief. In March of 2017, the UUA's Director of Congregational Life, who was the Reverend Scott Taylor at the time, hired Reverend Andy Burnett, who was a senior minister in Chandler, Arizona, and also a UUA trustee, and also a white man, to replace the retiring leader of the southern region of the UUA, Reverend Ken Herto, who is also white. All three men, all three white. News of Burnett's hiring and his subsequent resignation from the UUA Board of Trustees came out during a time when UU religious professionals of color were gathered in Baltimore for their annual Finding Our Way Home retreat. One of those religious professionals was called Christina Rivera. She's the director of administration and finance at Thomas Jefferson Memorial Church in Charlottesville. She was also a UUA trustee. She identifies as Chicana Latina. She told colleagues at the retreat that she had been a finalist for that job, but had been told she was not the right fit for the team. Over the next week, social media went crazy. People claiming that the UUA had hired another white person over an unidentified woman of color who was also a qualified finalist for the Southern Region job. Critics were pointing out that the five regional leads who supervise the 50 members of the UUA's congregational life staff who work throughout the United States were all white ministers, as was Taylor, their supervisor, and only two of Taylor's 10 colleagues on the UUA's leadership council were people of color. The outcry was intense and unrelenting. It was like the straw that broke the camel's back, and the dams were opened. I'm mixing my metaphors. You know what I mean. The UUA board was flooded with emails. One of those emails was a letter signed by 121 UU ministers and other religious professionals that said, "The practice of hiring white people nearly to the exclusion of hiring people of color is alarming and not indicative of the communal practice to which our faith calls us." Noting in this letter that people of color make up no more than 11% of any rank UU employees, except service workers, where they are 84% of employees. The letter called for a change in hiring practices and a public conversation about monitoring the association's success in creating a multicultural staff. Blue, also known as Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism, was an organizing collective in our denomination, called it a moment of crisis for our faith. On March 27th, they put out a statement that said, "We cannot effectively respond to looming threats of white supremacy beyond us until we tackle the white supremacy within us. Specific, drastic, and swift changes are needed." Now, that might have been the very first time that white supremacy was used as a descriptor for UUs. Any of you who might remember this crisis probably had your own reaction to that moment. People throughout Unitarian Universalism certainly did. It was very challenging for us to think of UUs as any part of anything labeled white supremacist. We really hated that language. And it didn't feel right or good for a very long time. And in fact, the UUA president at the time, Peter Morales, himself identified as Latino, pushed back against that label, rejecting the idea that we as UUs could also be called white supremacist. He called for patience and named in response to the outcry the progress the UUA had made in increasing diversity of its staff, which is true. We had gone from 14 to 20% over the last 7 or 8 years. But to the people of color and their allies in this crisis, it felt like nothing more than the old rhetoric, a lack of understanding or a willingness to hold anyone accountable. And in some cases, Morales' response created more harm and more hurt. Now, his response to that very dark moment was to resign. just 2 weeks after the controversy exploded and just 3 months before the end of his natural term, he resigned from the board, saying, "In my hasty effort, I created more hurt for those already hurting. I have clearly lost the trust of many people, and my comments have become a focal point in the ongoing discussion. It is clear to me that I am not the right person to lead our association as we work together to create the processes and structures that will address our shortcomings and build the diverse staff we all want." I remember hearing about his resignation, and my first feeling was anger. I now can respect his own personal struggle, and I trust that he made the best decision he could, knowing what he knew at the time. But in that moment, it felt like such a betrayal and an abandonment. He walked into the labyrinth and then turned around and walked back out while the rest of us were getting pushed in. Not so gently, even. In fact, in many ways, as a denomination, we are still being digested by that crisis. But we haven't stopped moving. We haven't stopped going. We've learned more about white supremacy culture. We've listened deeply to the experiences of those most affected by it. We've paid attention to the way our skin crawls when we have to own that we're a part of it. We have so far to go. But we are so much less afraid of what we'll learn, I think. So much less defensive about the roles we play in perpetuating harm. We have become resilient through our commitment to justice over comfort. We still have a long way to go. And love over ego. We still have a long way to go. The UUA, following Peter Morales' resignation, elected a brilliant combination, a three-person presidency, three powerful people of color to stabilize, teach, motivate, and comfort: the Reverend Bill Sinkford, the Reverend Leon Spencer, and the Reverend Sophia Betancourt, who is now our current acting president. In the midst of that crisis, to me, being a seminarian, understanding deeply what I thought I understood and having it all ripped away, it felt like the whole of Unitarianism, Unitarian Universalism, might collapse. It felt like we were the furthest we could possibly be from who we wanted to be, when in actuality, again, as a denomination, we were closer than we'd ever been to walking the talk of our faith. Our work in the world is more real, imperfect, but less hypocritical, and honestly open to being changed by truth in a way that it hadn't been before, never bouncing back, which I think is what Peter Morales had hoped would happen, that an apology and a resignation would just settle everything down and we would continue on the way that we were. Understandable, but absolutely impossible. Scary, but necessary. Did you hear Siri? We are better for it. We could have believed that naming ourselves a part of white supremacy would actually, Who would have believed that naming ourselves a part of white supremacy would actually begin to free us from it? But of course it did. Of course it did. And looking back, we see the path that we walked so clearly. But in the moment, there's only fog and darkness. In this way, resilience is moving through and letting ourselves be changed. And finally, in large part, it seems to me that the problems we're facing in this country right now are caused by that same energy, that same desire to go back to some imagined past that was never real, that people imagine was easier, clearer, required less emotional energy, less risk of breakdown. We tell ourselves stories about how much easier it was when there were very clear gender roles and gender identities, when no one in the margins dared ask anything, when we accepted our place in the hierarchy and the patriarchy, when everyone said the pledge and waved the flag and never questioned why. When we tolerated difference but didn't honor it. There are many in our country who are so scared and do not want to walk through this labyrinth, who do not want to be changed, who don't want to be eaten and digested. Come on, I get it. There are people who cannot tolerate the struggle inherent in moving through, and so they're trying really hard to pull us back, to snap us back into the prison of our own making. And some days it feels like we are the furthest from where we want to be, and I find hope in thinking maybe we're the closest we've ever been. We are still bravely walking toward the center, ready and willing to be more than we ever imagined, ready to be changed, together pushing others in one at a time, gently but firmly into this unknown, into this trusting, into this heart of us all. So in our personal lives and in our organizations and in our country, may we never lose compassion for the fear that change and struggle bring. But may we also never stop pushing forward because of it. Amen. May it be so.